Today is Thursday. It's July 13th. Where did the summer go, 2017? It's 11:14 in the morning. I'm John Williams, and this is The Mincing Rascals. It's a weekly podcast we record at the studios of WGN Radio. Portions of this can be heard on my Saturday morning show at 11:10 a.m. on WGN.
And I'm Kristen McQuarrie, a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board.
I'm Eric Zorn, the high-quality columnist for the Tribune. I run Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays.
Steve Bertrand, the whatever, is not able to join us today, the WGN radio newsman and talk show host, so we will roll the three of us here. Okay, guys, welcome back. Let's talk a little bit about, we'll start, Eric suggested this week, local, maybe even small, and then build to you-know-who and you-know-what. So we'll begin with Lakeshore Drive. Everybody loves Lakeshore Drive, especially the part beginning at Navy Pier and going north through a couple of almost 90-degree turns past Oak Street Beach. State and local officials have just revealed a plan to even out those curves, move the beach, and build more usable space for parking and pedestrians and bikes. I did not see the cost of this, but it has to be tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, billions or zillions of dollars. I don't know. Do you guys like the idea? Do you think that's a problem that needs to be fixed?
You know, I feel ill-equipped to describe it because I'm only ever on South Lakeshore Drive. But from the times that I do travel north.
Oh, that's right. You come up from the south suburbs and get off right where this fix would start.
Side, John.
What did I say?
Suburbs. Sorry. South side. But I guess the congestion is to a point where it's actually dangerous at some of these exits. But Eric, you live up that way. What do you think?
Well, I live northwest, but yeah, I love the idea. Totally love the idea. They're going to add, you know, lakefront parkland, there, yeah. Which is like what they have on the south side.
The renditions, you know, look beautiful. And the south side of Lakeshore Drive, the parks along there are lovely.
It's a great place. I think it's a terrific
idea.
It's lost
on a lot of people.
I have the same question you do about how much it's going to cost. Yeah. I think hundreds of millions is certainly, probably even conservative, given how much, you know, the landfill they have to do. We're talking about, you know, hundreds of feet of landfill going out into the lake. But it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous idea. And straightening out those turns on Lakeshore Drive would be a wonderful idea also. Maybe adding some high occupancy vehicle or bus lanes to make the commute times lower. Just, I think, basically a terrific idea, but again, where the money going to come from?
It's almost cheating when they put those artist renditions because they always look so spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
There's never any congestion. There's never debris in the beach. It just always looks lovely. And you go, oh, yeah, I'll have that. I don't think it's a great idea. First of all, I kind of like the charm of the two turns.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of cool.
And all the accidents.
I don't miss the S curves, but I think this is. It would be better if we did this. But good Lord, this is Illinois talking. I mean, mm-hmm. Seriously.
Right.
I mean, we'll talk about school funding here in a second, but that's a great idea. And if Bill Gates or somebody wants to drop some money here and fund it, you bet, you bet. But if it's going to cost $1 million or more, I think it's not a priority.
It's going to be more than $1 million.
It's going to be a little bit more.
Well, now you know my answer.
And I think I've been trying to get on south, taking Lakeshore Drive south and trying to get on the Dan Ryan now for, there's been a huge construction project,
yeah.
New ramp, for 2 years. I mean, it is the amount of time that it takes for the city to finish these projects. And I've been told, I can't verify that this is true, but the city too is so far behind in paying its contractors that they don't even show up some days. So the length of these, you know, the amount of time that it takes to complete
really?
These projects is just off the charts. And this would be massive. I mean, just the congestion that it would create. So what's the cost benefit here? Is it safety? Is it more aesthetics? I'm just not sure
it's
worth it.
It's all aesthetics. And I don't think you can quantify. I mean, it'll make Chicago a cooler place to be. I don't know that you can quantify.
No.
That.
And you know what? That's one thing we've got going for us. I mean, when you think about how screwed up Cook County, Chicago, and Illinois are, pick it. It's a beautiful city.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fun city. This is one thing we do well and should not lose. But I don't think we can afford more. We got Millennium Park. Navy Pier's a little nicer now. Eric, you can't be serious about moving forward with something like this.
Well, I want to see where the money's going to come from. It might just be they could get federal dollars or something.
I know. Let's get George Lucas. Let's call him up.
excuse me.
Yeah. Say, our bad.
All is forgiven.
Whoops.
I would do a trade. If you can, we'll give you that if you give us this. You want to build your, what was it, Star Wars Museum?
I don't even think George Lucas in his wallet has enough money to do this.
Right. But
modern art or whatever it was, yeah.
And this is also, you have to remember too, these are projects that city officials put forth because it puts people to work. So that has a lot to do with it too. It's just trying to keep the construction trades happy versus whether or not it's really useful and needed.
Maybe Chicago, if they want a public works project, should find a better way to channel rainwater.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, other cities have addressed that. I don't know what we've done.
We have the deep tunnel.
We have the deep tunnel, but that's more south, isn't it?
Does the deep tunnel run
the length of the city?
It runs underneath my house almost.
Are you
the
serious?
Northwest side, yeah.
I didn't realize it was that extensive. It's doing good? Is it working?
I mean, it's taking 30, 40 years to complete.
And do we need another one? I mean, my gosh. We had two bad rains, and wow, the city is crippled.
Not the city so much. I think the suburbs are getting a lot of flooding. Mm-hmm. But the city is doing okay, I think. I mean, obviously there are always areas where there's flooding, but nothing like what it would have been without the deep tunnel. So,
one last thing about Lakeshore Drive's fix. It is true that between automobile transportation, pedestrians, and bicycles, this is my new commute. I've spent the last 3 months going up and down Lakeshore Drive, and I see the problem, you know.
Yeah.
And it's great. People are biking. They're using it, but they're using it to a fault. It can't accommodate the flow anymore. Mm-hmm. But it's also one of those issues, too, where you can see where the money gets spent sometimes, too, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whatever our priorities are, there's a more affluent class of people. There's tourists. And that's where we sometimes focus our attention and sometimes our money, when really this development of the South Side probably needs more money and attention than even this does.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the schools. We've got a budget, money for schools. The question is, I think, I mean, to me anyway, the $64 question now is how do we distribute it? Democrats would give $286 million to the Chicago Public Schools in their proposal. The Republicans want to give more to suburbs and downstate. Now, they might actually cut CPS funding by $30, $40 million. Kristen, what are you hearing and feeling about, at least it's a good problem to have. Now we got to figure out how to spend the money we've allocated.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a bill that the House and Senate passed. It's supposed to be sent to the governor. They haven't sent it yet because he said he would veto it. He's calling it a CPS bailout. The editorial page has taken issue with that. It is not a CPS bailout. It helps CPS, kind of brings them up to the same level with pension help that we give to every other district in the state. And then it does do a couple of other things to give a little bit more help to CPS. But come on, we all have to acknowledge CPS is the state's biggest school district with the most poverty kids, you know, the highest concentration of kids in poverty. So I don't think this is an overreach, the bill that is on his desk. It shovels $350 million of new money into the system and tries to rebalance school funding so that a lot of these downstate districts that are basically starved, they don't have a Schaumburg, they don't have a mall. They might have a gas station and a discount store, and that property wealth is trying to, and a Walmart, and they're trying to sustain a school system. They have been most hurt by the school funding formula, not CPS. So we support the governor signing the bill with a couple of small changes, and that's probably going to be the next biggest battle in Springfield is what his decision is.
Huge. There's an excellent story on the front page of the Tribune today, Thursday, by Hal Dardick and Kim Geiger.
Yeah.
And they explain—
It's a long story,
but it really explains, I think for the first time in the Tribune's pages, just sort of point by point, blow by blow, going back 30 years or so, how we came to this situation and why both sides in this do have an argument as to whether Chicago is getting special treatment or not, and you know what, how Chicago contributed to its own problems by not investing in its pension funds for 10 years.
Yeah, think about that.
Things like that. That you look at this, and the thing is that it is all – things are out of whack, and that, you know, it's a long story, and so we can't get into it here in this podcast. But in a sense, what we've heard from Rauner's people is that it's 90% of what he wants. And he objects to 10% of it. So he wants, maybe he's going to line out and veto it. It seems to me that when you get 90% of what you want, that's pretty good. And you might as well, you should probably sign off on this and move forward, because there's a lot of anxiety and there's a companion story that talks about the anxiety in a lot of school districts around the state, not just Chicago, about whether they're going to get money to open up this fall and how long they can keep operating without state money. So it seems like the statesmanlike thing to do is take your 90%. Sign the bill and move on. But that doesn't seem to be where Governor Rauner's head is these days.
Don't say it's unconstitutional. But isn't there a way for us to just renege on the pension plans that we have to pay into?
No. No. Mm-mm.
Really?
Nope.
I mean,
we cannot renege on them. We can make changes going forward for new workers, or we can give them options to voluntarily give up some of their benefit. But who's going to do that?
I don't know. I read a piece by one of the union heads, and he said, no, you have to honor it. And I get that. But I wonder if the recipients of these generous pensions feel any guilt or anxiety, any sort of burden of, wow, the state's screwed, the schools are screwed, everybody's screwed, because everybody signed these deals which were either not funded or not practical. And there you
are.
Or
outlandish in some cases.
I know.
You've got superintendents who got these huge bonuses for the end of their career.
I just wonder if any of them feel bad. Give us a call if you do. 312-981.
I don't think any of them feel bad.
They should. I mean, they are the lucky recipients of some foolhardy deals that were made. And today and going forward, we still have to deal with that.
I think all of them feel like they say, well, yes, I'm getting twice as much as maybe I should, but it's a $250 billion. Is that the right figure these days, the pension?
$250 billion in unfunded liabilities.
So yeah. What would my couple thousand dollars a year do if I turned it back to the state? I mean, I don't think that individuals feel individual guilt over
No raindrop feels that it's the reason for the flood.
Well, I mean, so to
write
their,
that down, will you? I think that's pretty profound.
John Williams, July 13th.
In their defense, they blame the state not fully funding, and the state also took pension holidays. And their case is, we paid in, the state didn't pay in. These unfunded liabilities continue to grow. I tend to think that the unions have been just overly territorial about it. If they would agree to some changes in contracts going forward, we could reduce some of these costs. I think people realize 3% compounded raises every year, and by the time you have paid in, you're reaping way more out of the system because the investment returns haven't added up than you put in the first place. I think they get that. And when I used to speak before teacher organizations in particular, they were okay with having their pensions taxed, especially if it was a small tax that went toward education funding. But nobody wants to raise that issue of taxing pensions.
We're one of three states that doesn't tax retirement income.
Right. So is it really? I thought there were more.
I
thought there were
just three.
But anyway, that's another.
It's on a podcast. It's got to be true.
Okay. We'll go with it.
Well, they tax you. A lot of retirement income gets taxed.
Well, federally it gets taxed. Sure. But state income doesn't get taxed.
Yeah. Well, all right. Let's do that. I mean, I don't know. I don't know what the fix is, but I don't have a Wayback Machine. And have we put anybody in jail for this? Could we take Blagojevich out of jail and put him back in jail for this? Is there anybody currently serving in government who we could pin this on?
They all bear responsibility. Both parties, all of them, because they were making payments into these systems, watching the liabilities rise. So they knew they weren't putting enough money in, and they were counting on in
they
some
were doing
cases
that legally.
Yes, 7 or 8% returns. Well, they make the law, John. They decide. We all talk about the pension ramp that was put in place in 1995 for state pensions. If they couldn't make the payment that year, they just changed the law. That's what they did. And the SEC actually in 2013 charged Illinois with fraud for not being upfront with our bond buyers about how much debt we were in.
The lesson here, don't get Kristen started on
I know.
Pensions.
Okay, sorry.
Don't get her
snooze
started.
Fest.
No. It's interesting. I think it's a really interesting subject. But there's no answer to it right now because
there
we're
is.
So far.
Just
well, no,
don't
there really
pay.
Isn't.
Just tell them, sorry, we don't have the money anymore. Everybody can declare bankruptcy. Can't that obligation become bankrupt and we say, it's not there anymore, you're going to get 80 cents on the dollar? That's not constitutional, right? We can't do that.
Well, if one of the municipalities filed for bankruptcy, that's what happens in bankruptcy court. Everybody takes a haircut, but the state cannot file for bankruptcy. So,
let's talk a little bit about the Chicago Sun-Times. There's been some stories this week about the ownership of that. In fact, the specter of there not being a Chicago Sun-Times was raised. Eric, Kristen, what's happening in the print media here in town?
Well, last night, Wednesday night, a deal was struck. Edwin Eisendrath is a former alderman in town, 59-year-old liberal Democrat, and he has put together a consortium of investors who got, Kristen, was it $11.4 million, something like that, dollars in funding ready. So they announced that they purchased the Sun-Times for a dollar, which is the same thing, same price that the paper itself costs every day. They purchased the newspaper for a dollar, and they're going to run it. And it's a consortium that includes, I think, 40% of the investors are union people, right?
Is that correct?
Unions? And they're going to run it. And of course, this supersedes or blocks the deal that Tronc, Tribune, the company that publishes the Chicago Tribune and other publications, we were going to, our paper was going to buy the Sun-Times and keep operating it independently. A lot of people were skeptical that Tronc was going to do that. So this, again, this means that the Sun-Times will continue as an independently operated.
Does the Sun-Times make money? Is that a profitable newspaper?
No. I think they lose. Well, I don't want to. I did hear some numbers today, but it was sort of in-house. I'm not allowed to reveal. But no, it's a money-losing operation.
Well, that's too bad because I like that newspaper. It's different. I read it every day, and I get things from it that I don't get from your paper and vice versa. Lord, I don't get things from it that I get from the Chicago Tribune. And the Tribune's the big dog on the block. But would you guys like to see the Sun-Times survive and
absolutely
compete with
yes, of course. I love the Sun-Times.
Why do you say all of that?
I mean, I think they have an excellent reporting staff. I mean, some of the work that Tim Novak, I love Dan Milopoulos, I like their columnists, I love Mary Mitchell. Their editorial page, we go toe-to-toe routinely. That's good. It's healthy. I love Fran Spielman's coverage of City Hall. I mean, this wasn't about anybody rooting for the Sun-Times to go down. I think there was some, I perhaps am naive enough to believe that if the Tribune would have purchased it, the value is in keeping the brand of the Sun-Times. And it wouldn't have turned into this mushy, you know, people consider us to be more conservative-leaning paper. I think it would have kept its voice and been on more stable footing than it will be now.
I am not confident that this deal is the best for the people over there. I mean, I wish that I were, because I think I do whatever's best for them is what I think. And whatever's best for them is best for the city. But I'm not sure that the resources that they're putting together with this investment group is going to be enough to offset the losses they're going to have, and that this isn't going to hasten their demise in some ways. I mean, I don't know, but the fact that this independent group is running it may not be great news for them. And Kristen also will raise some issues about whether how to think about the fact that it's going to be run by or going to be owned by these labor interests.
It just strikes me that the news that came out of this deal was all very celebratory, and these people are so heroic for putting the resources together and saving their local paper. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. But if you had a local – so this is Edwin Eisendrath, who is a wealthy liberal Democratic, former Chicago alderman, ran for governor at one point, and organized labor. I mean, the Chicago Federation of Labor, Ask Me, SEIU, all of these groups that have very driven political agenda buying a newspaper, you flip that and you say if you had Dick Uihlein, who's a local big Republican funder, connecting up with somebody like the Illinois Policy Institute and buying the Sun-Times, you would have people running for the hills. The idea that we don't even like blink at the idea that some really democratic, politically driven people have just purchased a newspaper. I just wish the reaction were equal. There's all this outrage when right-wingers buy a radio station or do this or that. Here we have some of the biggest democratic powerhouses in the city and in the state buying a newspaper, and everyone thinks it's great.
Well, we survived Sam Zell, who is an arch-conservative owner, and he did not meddle or do much with the news coverage of the Tribune. And actually, the editorial stances were fairly consistent as well. I mean, there's a tradition of people who own newspapers who go in and really mess with the editorial board positions, but they don't tend to meddle with the news operation. So I'm not
with reporting,
as
reporting per se.
Let's wait and see. Obviously, with anytime something like this happens, but I think the journalists over at the Sun-Times have a lot of integrity, and their coverage has shown it. And in the news department, I don't see them skewing their coverage to please their corporate overlords. Just like our news department didn't do that when Sam Zell owned us, and. You see this over and over again in newspapers around the country. So, you know, I'll take a wait and see on this, and I would hope that the new owners would put this in mind. They can do what they want with the editorial page. I don't think they have to do a whole lot, because I think that editorial page
It aligns with their interests already.
It aligns already. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of changes in what you see from the Sun-Times in terms of coverage. So,
you know, I think has a legitimate reason to be a little apprehensive, and I'll take a wait-and-see attitude, too, our WGN radio and TV, because Sinclair will own these properties, and that is a conservative group.
Right, and they have more of a track record of actual interference, right? I wanted to read some more of that coverage, but, you know, inserting stuff into the newscast that must be read or...
And that strikes me, boy, I'll tell you what, in my entire career, and this is the only thing I've ever done, I've been doing it for, gosh, 35 years, I've never had a program director or general manager tell me, and I know a lot of them are so much more conservative than I am, and I know they don't like some of the things that have come out of my mouth. I could count on one hand the time any of them in my entire career have pulled me aside and said, hey, you need to be a little fairer to the other side, even though I know they're probably gritting their teeth and taking angry phone calls. It's just not done. It's not even practical in a way. You can't tell somebody who has a certain set of views and you know, a show comes out of your mouth. You can't tell somebody to do a different show. It is what it is. That person is who they are.
And that's true, I have to say, of column writing, too, that in all the years I've been writing column for the Tribune, I have not had any interference like that from the bosses, and I have not heard of any other columnists having that either.
That's funny, because if the Tribune is a conservative newspaper, you read a Rex Hupke, you read an Eric Zorn. Mary Schmick doesn't dip her toes into political waters too much, but I think we all know how she feels about these issues.
Darlene.
Except for John Cass, who is really writing a conservative-leaning daily column in the Chicago Tribune. It's interesting to me, right? I read the columns, and I think that it's generally liberal enough.
Well, that we certainly get more complaints that we're too liberal and people drop their subscriptions because they believe we're
nice going,
too liberal.
Zorn. Thanks a lot. You get those, don't you? I'll never listen to your station again. I'm never going to Goods Furniture in Kewaunee because of what you just said about the president.
Yeah.
Every day.
I got some lovely, lovely tweets this morning about what a whack job I am. But similarly, I've worked at – I was like, oh, thank you. The Tolerant Left – I've worked at five.
Let me show you my email from this past
right,
week.
Right, I know, I know. Eric gets beat up.
Do you want to talk about which side is more tolerant of which side?
No, I don't know that's
an argument anybody
They're
can
ugly
win.
Ugly
anyway.
On both sides, but I have worked at five newspapers, a radio station, and for an online publication, and I have never been told what to write. I mean, it's collaborative. It bubbles up. You know, I would come into the now. I've never been high up. Maybe that happens to my bosses. But this idea that when somebody buys a paper, they, you know, come into the newsroom and make changes and tell you to write certain ways, I have never experienced that.
There are examples where the platform does take a position and everybody falls in line. MSNBC or Fox News, for instance. I've been clicking on Fox's coverage of the Donald Trump Jr. story a lot just to see how they're covering it. And you can tell where you are the second you start to read their headlines. Let's talk a little bit about the Donald Trump Jr. story. Last June, President's son, Jared Kushner, and I want to say Steve Bannon, but it wasn't Steve Bannon, it was Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort took a meeting with a Russian lawyer under the pretext that a woman had helpful dirt from the Russians on the Hillary Clinton campaign. The meeting appears to be a bait and switch. Trump Jr. says there was no useful information given to them, but he did not know that when he took the meeting. In fact, in an email response, he said if there was dirt on the Clintons from Russia, he would love to see it. Since then, the president, who doesn't have much time for TV, he says, has applauded his son for transparency and criticized the media for now the second greatest witch hunt ever. Did he commit a crime? Is Donald Trump Jr. in big trouble here?
Perhaps, and yes. I think if you are... What he should have done is call the FBI when someone says, hey, the Russian government wants to give you some oppo research on Hillary Clinton and mess in our investigation. He should have called the FBI. He should have said, no, thank you, call the FBI. He didn't. Now, I think that was probably as
He's
much—
He's a rookie.
As
Eric,
much
he doesn't know
no, no,
how
no,
the game
I think, I think it's true. I think in some ways that's true, that he really was vastly inexperienced. He probably didn't occur to him to do that and didn't know what the rules were. But it was a pretty major blunder on his part.
So I agree it was a major blunder. It wasn't the Russian government, though. It's a distinction that must be made. It was a friend of a friend hooking him up with an attorney, And again, lack of vetting of this attorney. She's not just any old attorney. She has been very involved in lobbying to remove the name of it is escaping my mind.
The Mansk Act or whatever
yes.
it is.
So and so because of her role there, I have a hard time thinking that the Kremlin wasn't somehow aware of her because she was fighting for their side over here to repeal this law. But in terms of illegality, again, sitting through a meeting with these two people, not furthering the act. There's no furtherance of the act. They didn't do anything. They didn't take anything. From what I've read, it could be considered a campaign violation had they gotten some dirt on her, but that's kind of sketchy. If he has already been interviewed and lied to the FBI, that's going to be a big problem. Or if there's some way that they can – if they continue down this road of them just not disclosing, like Jared Kushner, again, failing to update his security clearance forms – those are areas where they could get in trouble, but I'm still not seeing this as collusion and
criminal act. But you know, maybe it's not collusion. The defense they keep lobbying out there is that there was nothing actionable. There was no dirt, as though that gets them off the hook. If there had been, well, then we would be having a different conversation completely, or maybe none at all.
Well, that's what they're saying, John. How do we believe Donald Trump Jr. now? I mean, he's forgotten this meeting. It's very difficult to credit what he says that nothing happened at this meeting. And as far as it being not connected to the Russian government, I think if you look at that email trail, there seems to be a very strong suggestion that this is coming from the Russian government.
From that Goldstone guy.
Yeah.
Well,
he's like a movie producer.
He's a goofball.
I actually believe Donald Jr.'s story when he says that it was oversold. They wanted to get this meeting.
I do, too.
But it's in writing, as Eric says.
Yeah, but the writing is from Goldstone saying that this is the Russian government's continued support for the president. But Goldstone has no credibility in this. He's just pumping himself up to get a meeting for the lawyer.
It wasn't
from the Russians per se.
What did Donald Trump Jr. think was going to happen in that meeting? Did he believe that this information
Absolutely.
Was going to come, was coming from the highest levels
yes,
of the Russian government?
I think he did, and that's the incriminating part.
Yeah. And the question is, how is this going to play? There's this interesting sort of long game about what happens to Trump, but there's also the short-term game. How does this affect his juice in Washington? How does this affect his tax overall? How does this affect the health care bill?
How do you answer that?
I think it harms them a great deal. I think that he doesn't – because his popularity numbers remain low.
You don't believe this is the distraction game that he's intentionally running to let Mitch McConnell do his work?
No, I don't think so.
I think that's a stretch. I think that's sort of a – I don't buy that either. There's no good sense in this. Donald Trump.
The reporting I see is that the White House is in sort of in panic chaos mode these days over this.
Let's wrap up. Kristen, unless you have any other last words.
I don't. Shockingly.
This is the last word. Our recommendations for the week, something we're reading, watching, or listening to, or consuming that we think you might enjoy.
So I loved, just for entertainment value, this back and forth between Sebastian Gorka, who is a Trump deputy something-something in the White House, and the CNN reporter. I mean, he just is relentless in going after CNN and how much they're covering the Russia. It's overkill for sure. But Google Sebastian Gorka and watch his back and forth with this CNN reporter. And he tries to take down mainstream media and focuses on how much time they're spending on this. And it's entertaining.
I mean, if you want to see collusion, it's in the DNC.
So,
I mean, it is
so, but
up
you're,
to
okay,
their
so,
necks.
So just let me follow your line of logic. You're saying it's inappropriate for the Democrats to meet with a foreign country, Ukraine, but it's not inappropriate for your campaign, for Donald Trump, to meet with the Russians.
What do you mean the Russians? Who did this woman work for at the time? Do you know?
Well, this is the question, Mr. Gorka.
I am reading a book called The Seeds of Life. It's about the fact that for much of modern history, human beings did not know how babies were made. We knew that intercourse created life, but what does that mean? What was actually happening inside a human body that generated another life, like sperm and eggs and how twins were made and all of that stuff? And while they sort of thought they had it figured out in 1600, when the dawn of great science in the world, it goes all the way to 1900. We were 300 years still not knowing how things reproduced. And it's a sort of an interesting telling of science and biology and history in that. And I'm not deep into that book, but I've started it, and I think I'm going to like it, The Seeds of Life.
Are you going to interview the author on your radio
I'm thinking
program?
About it. That's kind of why I'm reading it.
What is this? What is this sperm egg thing you speak of?
You know, I thought about that before. Like, I suppose what really compels human beings to procreate is the enjoyment that at least one of them gets. I wonder when it dawned on them, like 9 months later, wait a minute, you have a baby. Did that happen because of what happened? Think about that sort of intellectual.
Probably observed this behavior in animals and put
noticed
it together.
But even then, there's a time lag. Like if she had a baby the next day, you'd go, I'll bet I know what it was. But gestations periods being what they are, I've always wondered, when did somebody go, wait a minute, I think I got this idea here.
Hey.
All right, what have you got, Eric?
I have something. The New York Magazine cover story this month, David Wallace Wells has a story headlined, The Uninhabitable Earth, Famine, Economic Collapse, A Sun That Cooks Us, What Climate Change Could Wreak Sooner Than You Think.
Oh, great. Thank you, Eric. It's, that sounds like great summer
reading. It is what some people call
uplifting.
Some people call it extinction porn. I mean, it is extremely bleak look at what climate change is doing to our planet and what 100 years from now this Earth's going to look like. There is a companion article, though, in The Atlantic by Robinson Meyer called Are We As Doomed As That New York Magazine Article Says?
Nice.
So you read those two together, you get a good sense of the debate that's going on.
I think the headlines on that Antarctic iceberg that cleaved off the shelf sea that's twice the size of Luxembourg have been almost irresponsible. I mean, they have really been calamitous. And my read on it is that it's not necessarily because of global warming. This happens. It's a big deal, but it's not the end of the earth.
It says it's the size of Delaware. Does that even mean anything to you?
It kind of doesn't.
It's like the size of this desk.
Twice
Delaware.
Luxembourg doesn't really. I know. Our parking lot, I believe, is Rhode Island. So I don't know how that helps me. But I guess it's really big. You know, the line that compelled me to go, okay, this is a big deal, is that they said we'll have to redraw the maps of Antarctica. And I go, okay, now something happened there. Mm-hmm. And that wraps up this week's edition of The Mincing Rascals. Thank you, Christy McQuarrie and Eric Zorn. The likes of Scott Stantis and certainly Steve Bertrand will join us in a future broadcast. Bob Ferguson is the engineer of The Mincing Rascals. It's produced by Elif Garris. I'm John Williams. Remember, portions of this broadcast Saturday mornings at 11:10 a.m. on WGN. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to The Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNradio.com. Just click on the WGN Plus tab. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus Podcast Network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.